It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. It has been nearly 50 years since the original book, Wisconsin Death Trip, was published. It's often described as an eerie collection of black and white photos of Black River Falls between 1885 and 1900. The Wisconsin Historical Society refers to the book as a cult favorite. A Dartmouth College English professor follows in some of its footsteps, interviewing residents in that community and others like Marinette, Cecil, Waukesha. And this new collection really puts white nationalism into sharper focus. And we're going to talk about that. Call with your questions about Wisconsin Death Trip, past and present, 800-642-1234. Jeff Charlotte is an author, journalist, and director of creative writing at Dartmouth College. An excerpt from his forthcoming book was recently published in Vanity Fair. Jeff, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, it's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with, what is a death trip? Put it into words for us.
Well, a death trip, this idea of Wisconsin death trip, which I came to because the author of that original book, Michael Lessie, was my teacher 30 years ago. And when I found myself wandering Wisconsin after fall Roe v. Wade, I realized, oh, this is sort of what I'm doing. And in one sense, it's what used to be called a memento mori, a reminder that everybody dies. But I called Michael from the road and I said, Michael, you know, tell me more about that book, Wisconsin Death Trip. And he put it in terms of an old Jewish story, a great teacher, a rabbi, who holds his classes in a graveyard. And the students say, why are we studying here? And the rabbi says, this is where you go. This is, in essence, it's the rock bottom. This is the reminder of death so that you can see life. And I think a death trip can be misunderstood as it is gloomy. It's a tour through gloom. But it is a kind of also a way of sifting through that gloom for some light, for some hope, for a future ahead.
I want to seize on a couple words you used there. You said it summons us to the precarious real. What is the precarious real to you?
I think, well, because this piece was sort of built around the day after Dobbs v. Jackson, the day Roe v. Wade fell, and I found myself in Wisconsin on family business. But here, Wisconsin was at that time the only blue state where abortion appeared as if it was going to be illegal, and was at that. Remember that first day, no one was quite sure what was going to happen. And I think all over there were so many people who believed that Roe v. Wade was not something that could be touched, And I think this speaks to, in the same way that we look at the approach of what so many of the people I spoke to see as an oncoming civil war. The precarious real is the real in which everything is vulnerable. Nothing can be taken for granted, not Roe v. Wade, not a democratic transfer of power, not even in some places, the safety of our neighbors. And I think when we recognize that, it can be scary, and you can turn, as some of the people I spoke to do, to this sort of doomsday prepping thing, or you can say, I must attend more forcefully to the work of making democracy, to the work of loving my neighbor rather than fearing them.
So you start your death trip the first night of the January 6th hearing. So this is early June. You're on the road in Wisconsin as the Supreme Court rules, on abortion. How do these, you know, pretty significant monumental events factor into what you do along the way in rural Wisconsin and how you talk with people?
Well, I'd been working on this book called The Undertow, this current that's been sort of pulling us out toward the possibility of civil war, certainly not an inevitability. And so I'd been thinking about these. I've been driving across the country for a while, and folks say, like, why Wisconsin? And I'm like, oh, no, trust me, my book's not just Wisconsin. You can tell the story, and I have in California, Nevada, and Utah, and Colorado, in my home, very blue state of Vermont.
So I shouldn't ask you the question, does every state have their own Wisconsin death trip?
Yes, they certainly do. They certainly do. But I think it it sort of spoke the reason I ended up talking to these folks was because I was out in Wisconsin, as it happens, driving my 13-year-old out to a program out there. And we decided to drive back roads across the country. And we're passing just like mile markers. These flags I would describe as fascist flags. Now, some of them are Trump 24 flags, and we can argue about whether that's a fascist flag. Some of them are the yellow don't tread on me flag. A lot of them are flags using language that I can't use on radio, but my child is seeing everywhere, flying from these suburban houses, rural houses, even townhouses, you know? And then some of them are the all black American flag, which some listeners may know is a flag of no quarter, no surrender, no mercy. It's an exterminationist flag. It's a flag that says a civil war is coming and we will take no prisoners. We'll kill everyone. And it's a terrifying thing. And I'm driving with my queer 13-year-old who was looking at this and sort of saying, like, these people do not like me. And so I became really interested in like this moment that people are putting these flags. Not only are they holding these views, but they want their neighbors to know. And in some places, they want their neighbors to be frightened, or they want to threaten those who might come by. I mean, if you've got a flag with the F word in it, you're menacing. Mm-hmm. And so I decided in a kind of counterphobic way, okay, let me go and talk to those people. And that's sort of what I've been doing for years as a writer. It's like, well, let me see, not as a one who parachutes in, but I've always thought, okay, I want to understand the far right. I don't want to just sort of say it's one big monolith. What are their fears? What drives them? Not sympathy, but a kind of, yes, empathy, not solidarity, but what does it look like to be a person who is so armed against the world?
I'm going to reintroduce you, and we're going to go into one of these conversations with a family. Jeff Charlotte is here, professor of English at Dartmouth College, writer's recent exploration of white nationalism, a piece in Vanity Fair. You can join in at 800-642-1234. So in Marinette, you meet the Brum family after stopping to photograph a flag cursing Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada. You're invited in. Can you, and I know, you know, radio is not a great medium for visuals, but what did you see and what were those interactions like, especially with Rob?
So Rob is the patriarch of this family and a leader of a militia. Which he said is some 6,000-7,000 strong. That may be an exaggeration, but there was plenty of evidence that there is a real militia there. He's got you come in and it's on the one hand, a sort of a crowded house of a lot of kids. There's a 3-year-old, there's a 20-something-year-old. There's some other kids, you know, there's toys, cats, and there's a pool table. And on the pool table is, AR-15s, boxes of ammo, body armor, sights, the kind of pistol he describes as a Dirty Harry pistol. And, you know, I'm not a person who's afraid of guns. I am a gun owner myself, nothing like this. And but this is not, you know, this is not a rural Wisconsin hunter's setup. There's night vision, there's all this kind of stuff. And of course, he's very open about being a militia. He's very open about having been at January 6th, at the January 6th insurrection. In fact, on the corner beside his F. Trudeau flag is, and he's all got all the flags on the wall, is a big screen TV that's playing on continual loop video footage he shot at the Capitol on January 6th, which is sort of you know, a trophy for him, something he's very proud of.
What did he tell you about Jan 6 and the events that occurred during the insurrection?
He was caring when I spoke to him, which is actually sort of why I accepted his invitation to the house when someone with a gun says, would you like to come inside? you better sort of go along with it. And I asked, I was curious, you know, were you carrying on January 6th? And he was coy. I mean, he was coy in the same way with the guns. He says, you can photograph these guns on the table. Everything you see on the table, this stuff is legal. You know, whatever that implication is, I don't know of what else might be there. He certainly was clear this was not all his weaponry. And in the same way he answered about January 6th, he said he wasn't foolish enough to say he was carrying his gun at the Capitol. He just said, let's just say I wasn't mugged on my way out of Washington. And which was a certain kind of very white imagination of what Washington is, that you can't go into a big city without carrying a gun or you'll be robbed. And with this imagination of, and I don't think I'm projecting, they're imagining this kind of black criminality that they fear. And which, you know, again, you hear that in a lot of places, this idea of cities as incredibly dangerous places. And I'm saying, but look, here's the place where you're completely armed up, including against his neighbors across the street, who he said were terrible people. And he had all kinds of perimeters that they couldn't cross. You know, this is the dangerous place. This house was the most dangerous place I went in Wisconsin.
On the issue of abortion, what was his response?
It was new to me. And that was one of the things that I wanted to do, because I think we sometimes assume that the right is monolithic. They all have sort of one reason. As many people as I spoke to, I encountered many sort of strange variations, misunderstandings of human biology or history and opposition to abortion. His was, he didn't particularly care personally, but as he put it, he said, abortions are bodies that can't go to my front line. And so he imagined that there might be a war with China, and this is after the Civil War that the United States will fight, and he needs troops to fight China. And he says, abortions means those are bodies that aren't going to fight. And he said he was particularly upset about abortion in the Black community, which he very incorrectly said, said that 40% of pregnant Black people have abortions. This is off by a wild, wild, wild factor, but that's what he imagined. And he wanted those Black children to grow up to be Black cannon fodder for the wars that he might wage for the sake of white supremacy.
Dartmouth College English professor and author journalist Jeff Charlotte with us on his Wisconsin death trip research and writing, interviewing 50 years later. Colin, about rural life in Wisconsin. Join the conversation, 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation on Wisconsin death trip nearly a half century later as author and journalist Jeff Charlotte follows in the footsteps of his former teacher, Michael Lessie. And the images and interviews in recent months, Jeff's road trip, really speak to this dangerous political divide brewing in our state. Join in this conversation by calling with your questions, your thoughts on the clash in ideologies, 800-642-1234. And Jeff Charlotte stays with us. Jeff, I want to talk about these flags because you really find the artistry in them and you find them really fascinating. And you've collected a lot of them. What do these banners signify to you?
I see them as a kind of fascist folk art and a sign of what is, from my political perspective, unfortunately, a very strong movement, a social movement. And we tend to think of art and movement as terms that are virtuous, but of course, as fascism knows, they are terms that can be taken. And so, you know, I, as I said, I was driving with my 13-year-old, we're seeing all these fascist flags, And I would say, you know, we'd get to like Milwaukee or Madison. And, you know, there's probably more rainbow flags, more Black Lives Matter flags in Wisconsin than these fascist flags, but they're concentrated in these cities. And moreover, they tend to be the same flag over and over and over and over. Whereas I think I photographed about 100 different variations of these fascist flags. And that's not including all the people who are DIY, making their own, devoting energy and time and money toward this expression of this anger and hate and violence. And that is an energized movement.
You called yourself, you know, a writer wandering Wisconsin, making pictures of flags. How did that sit with strangers when you wandered onto their property and sometimes started taking pictures right away?
Well, as a person, I would ask. I mean, mostly actually pretty well. And this is something I've sort of learned over the years. If you do something to call attention to yourself, you're hoping someone will ask. You fly a flag that has the F word on it. On the one hand, it's menacing. On the other hand, you feel really strongly about that. That family that I mentioned, the militia family, was the one where I just sort of, I saw the F Trudeau flag. I thought that was sort of odd. In Wisconsin, and it was his solidarity with his sort of fascist Canadian brothers. But so I stopped to take a picture, and they were immediately out because, of course, what was I thinking? They had cameras, they had all kinds of stuff. They clocked me from the second I was there. But you know, I have some advantages in this. I'm a middle-aged white man. There are other ways of being that I think that reporting would have been more difficult. And I always sort of think like, well, okay, I'm gonna put my white privilege to some good use and talk to the folks and find out what they're thinking and what ideas are motivating them. Because it's not enough just to say, well, they're just X or they're just Y. You know, as I think I show in the story with this very small sample, there is a range of currents. And that's what makes it a right-wing moment. It's not monolithic. It's many different streams converging. And it's important to map that.
You know, I mean, something from the original Wisconsin death trip from 73, it's, you know, it's real people, it's real places. But there is still that point of view. Did you come into this trip with a point of view, or did that evolve, or did some type of agenda evolve as you went through rural Wisconsin?
Oh, 100%. I mean, I'm a subjective writer. I am against fascism. I wasn't like, well, I wonder, F Biden, maybe that is a good flag. No, that wasn't open to that idea. Mm-hmm. I was open to hearing about that idea. Mm-hmm. And this is what I've been writing about these subjects for 20 years. And if anything, I think it's that kind of objective journalism, which is appropriate for some news. If I report on a fire, or if I report on like, here's just what happened. But that's a product of the Cold War. And if you go to the Black River Falls banner from the late 19th century that's in Wisconsin Death Trip, you hear the voice of the newspaper editors and their vision for what their town should be and their sorrow that it is not and their puzzlement. And I think all those things are important to express, including the puzzlement. I don't think we need to come with ready answers. I think sometimes we need to linger in these very hard questions.
Talking with Jeff Charlotte, journalist, author, contributor to Vanity Fair. You can join in along the way at 800-642-1234. Jeff, the Wisconsin Examiner recently critiqued your article for Vanity Fair, called your story a cheap shot that echoes negative stereotypes of people in rural areas. What is your response to that critique?
Well, it was disappointing because I love the Wisconsin Examiner, and I know Ruth Conniff's work and respect it. And I thought that was a pretty profound misreading in the sense that not only is it not a cheap shot, because it's not a shot at all. This is not an attack. And, you know, to me, like maybe the biggest problem with that is I end my story with a really wonderful group of young people whom I met in Black River Falls, Wisconsin. And just a group of young women, one teenage boy, all high school and early college kids. and in this very small town out there protesting for reproductive freedom. And they were mad as hell. I should say that. I can't even say their signs on the radio because they're looking at this world of coming ahead. And they're angry, and they are kids who grew up hunting. They know the way around guns. And they said, if there's going to, I said, you know, here are these other, here's, you know, these militias and so on. What do you think? They said, we're ready. You know, we're armed. Now, that's a posture of anger and defiance. And I think it's very understandable. But the Wisconsin Examiner said of these young people who are brave, who are like, how do I fight for my future? And I'm going to quote, said, yuck. And I said, well, yuck. That's not the way I respond to young people who are angry and about what's coming and are determined to fight for it. I don't call them a negative stereotype. And I don't call all people. I mean, the Brum family, which is Jewish, Nazi, Druidic, and really invested in powwows, is not a stereotype of anything. They are a strangeness, a complexity. A wrinkle in our assumptions.
We only have a few seconds left. And, you know, you end your piece with Wisconsin's official state motto, forward. And I just wonder, what does forward mean in light of the people you met, in light of the flags you saw?
The story was sparked by friends of friends who were trying to have a child through assisted reproductive technology. The mother-to-be was with her doctor when the ruling came down. The doctor came in crying. They'd been advised by their lawyer, the clinic, that they couldn't go forward. They were going to go forward anyway. They're going to bring this life into this dangerous world. That's what I think forward means. Jeff, that's the hope that you find.
Jeff, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Jeff Charlotte is an author, journalist, and professor of English at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.